Philip said.
She is, Gwen agreed. The problem is that before she did all that, she came to the past for the first time, 11 years ago, and found Atlantis here, already up and running. Then she met herself and discovered that she had gone back in time and built Atlantis so that it would be ready for her when she arrived.
There was a long silence, which ended with Philip yelling that this made no sense and that the whole thing was preposterous, followed by Martin agreeing with Philip, followed by Gwen agreeing with both of them, but assuring them that it was true, or at least it seemed to be.
Britt has a theory about how it happened. When she explains it, it makes sense.
Well, let's hear it, Martin said.
Gwen shook her head.
You'll have to ask her. It only makes sense when she explains it.
Philip grimaced.
I don't like it, he said.
Gwen said,
I knew you wouldn't,
putting a steadying hand on his shoulder.
You'll have plenty of time to ask Britt about all of this. For now, you just have to keep in mind that there are two Britts. We call them Britt the Elder and Britt the Younger, and they are the same person at two different ages.
Martin exhaled loudly.
That should be easy to keep straight,
Gwen added.
Oh, and I should mention that they're the same age, physically. You'll see.
The men did not seem reassured. Gwen pressed on.
The summit is Britt the Elder's idea. She saw early on that it would be easy for one of us to abuse our abilities. She wants to avoid that, but she needs everyone else to cooperate, and people don't like the idea of limiting their own power. Because she's the leader of the earliest known colony of time travelers, she has the luxury of time. She spoke to all of the girls who've come to Atlantis from all of the other colonies, pinpointed a moment a month or two after some time traveler tried to abuse his power, then invited leaders from that time to come here for a summit. That way she knew they'd be in the right frame of mind to cooperate.
And I'm sure Britt the Younger agreed,
Philip said ruefully.
No, Britt the Younger thought it was manipulative. They have a difficult relationship.
But they're the same person,
Philip cried. Gwen shrugged.
So that's why we were called now, Martin said. Because Jimmy tried to kill us all 2 months ago.
Which means she knows all about the Jimmy situation, Philip said. Well, that's a bit embarrassing.
Gwen said,
Don't be embarrassed. I told Britt the Elder the whole story, and she agreed that Jimmy had to go. She said that he was clearly dangerous, greedy, manipulative, and cruel.
Philip said,
I'm glad we're in agreement.
Gwen shielded her eyes with her hand and peered into the distance.
She also said that he lacked vision and thought too small.
What's that supposed to mean?
Martin asked. Gwen smiled.
Judge for yourself.
Gwen gestured ahead.
Gentlemen, the sunken city of Atlantis.
Martin and Philip shielded their eyes, and in the distance they saw it. The ocean was calm and vast. There were no islands to interrupt the flatness of the horizon, but in the distance there did appear to be a hazy collection of square-sailed ships. It was difficult to look at them. Something about how the light was shimmering made their eyes strain. It was also difficult to look at the ships because it was impossible to ignore what was above them. Hovering above the wavering, wobbling patch of sea, there were what appeared to be a great many tall buildings, just hanging in space. Seagulls soared above the impossible skyline, and the small armada of ships bobbed below.
Wow!
Martin gasped.
Yes,
Gwen said.
The genius of picking Atlantis as a base of operations is that it's destined to disappear anyway, so Britt was free to build anything she wanted. Of course, that was before she knew that nothing we do seems to affect the future anyway, but still, it was clever of her.
Martin whistled, then said,
One person built that? No wonder it took her 100 years.
She spent the first week designing the city and writing the construction algorithm. She set that in motion, and the basic construction was done in a few days. The rest of the time was spent establishing a culture, encouraging immigration, and creating a system of government. That was the hard part.
Philip said,
It took Jimmy years to build one castle, and he had an army of builders helping him. How on earth could this Brit of yours build that in a few days?
Gwen rapped on the side of the crystal clear bowl that was whisking them toward the city.
The same way we built this boat, and the bowl we sent you. You know how you copy coins and food items? We do the same thing with individual atoms, and instead of replicating the atoms in a hat, we place them precisely next to the last atom we copied, in a pattern predetermined by and automatically carried out by computer code. Domes are the strongest shape and the easiest one to program. She got the idea from a science fiction book she read. It had a lot of diamond domes in it, but she chose to make basins instead.
That explains how she built the buildings, Martin allowed. But how did she make them float in midair like that?
Gwen said,
She didn't. They float, but not in the air.
She leaned over close to Martin. She put a hand on his shoulder and put her head next to his, looking off into the distance in the same direction as him. She pointed at a ship at the edge of the shimmering armada.
Look at that ship on the end, with a blue-striped sail. See anything odd about it?
Yes, Martin said, squinting into the distance. It's sitting next to a ship with the exact same sail.
No, Gwen said. Look closer.
Martin squinted some more, then exclaimed,
It's sitting next to half a ship with the same sail.
It was now clear to Martin what he was looking at, and it wasn't what he'd first thought. They weren't buildings. They were just the tops of buildings. The empty space beneath them wasn't empty at all. It was the reflection in a giant, curving, mirrored wall. The shimmering wasn't magic. It was distortion from the curvature of the mirror and a mirage from the heat it was reflecting. The gathering of ships beneath the city was a much smaller gathering of ships around the city and their reflections. The city was not floating above the water, but rising up from it. They were approaching the city quite quickly now. Clearly, the flying half-bubble that Gwen kept referring to as a boat was moving deceptively fast. With the city looming ever larger in front of them, Gwen turned to Martin and Philip and said,
Look, guys, one last thing you should know. There are some things about Atlantis I'm not entirely proud of.
What do you mean? Philip asked.
You have to understand, she said. It's a society ruled entirely by women.
We expect it to be different, Martin said.
Yeah,
Gwen sighed.
Well, expect it to be different from what you expect.
The guys clearly did not understand what she meant.
I'll put it this way,
she continued.
Have you ever been to a bar where a bachelor party was going on?
Both men said yes. Gwen asked,
Have you ever been to a bar where a bachelorette party was going on?
Again, both men said yes. Gwen asked,
Which one was more out of control?
The craft started gaining altitude, flying above the ships, massed around the perimeter of Atlantis. Ancient Greek traders standing on their ships craned their necks and watched them fly overhead. As they approached the rim of the wall, Martin said,
Gwen, if it's a walled island, why do you keep calling it the Sunken City of Atlantis?
Gwen said,
You're thinking sunken as in sunken treasure. You should be thinking sunken as in sunken living room.
The craft crested the rim of the city and kept climbing. Looking at Atlantis from above, it was as if a gigantic hole had been dug into the ocean itself. The city was a perfect circle, and while there were tall buildings around its outer rim, the interior of the circle fell away sharply, forming yet another bowl shape. This one quite irregular, made up of windows, terraces, and rooftop gardens. All of the buildings were made of a smooth, gleaming white material, formed into flat surfaces joined with rounded edges. Tracks divided the city like slices cut into a pie. Broad, flat lifts, teeming with people, slowly inched up and down the tracks. Terraced footpaths, crowded with pedestrians, radiated around the city at regular intervals, interspersed with large public plazas where people could meet and enjoy the view. It was immediately clear to both Philip and Martin that the outer wall of Atlantis was nothing more than another molecularly pure diamond bowl, only much larger than any they had seen before. Glancing at the edge of the city, the bowl looked to be at least 3 feet thick. What they had taken for a wall had actually been the upper rim of the bowl extending above the waterline. Gwen confirmed this and added that it had been partially silvered for security and because it just looked cooler that way. In the center of the city, at the low point of the bowl, there was a large park. At the center of the park, there was some manner of pointy civic monument. Large, impressive buildings festooned with domes and columns surrounded the park on all sides. As their craft descended into the center of the city, it became clear that their destination was one of the buildings surrounding the central park. Martin could make out a low, flat building that appeared to be made up of various rectangles intersecting each other at right angles. It was as if they had taken the home of the wealthy villain from an action movie and covered it in reflective white paint. Large glass doors led to an immense balcony with two people standing at attention. Even from a great distance, he could tell that they were at high alert. Martin asked Gwen where they were going.
"To Brit the Elder's personal quarters," Gwen answered.
"Makes sense," Martin said. "I'm sure she wants to personally greet all of the delegates."
After a silence, Gwen said,
"Actually, no. She specifically said that she didn't want to meet any of the delegates until the formal reception tonight. Then she pulled me aside and told me to bring you two straight to her."
Philip didn't hear her, lost in his own thoughts. He looked down at the beautiful building and shook his head in disgust.
"Typical. She builds the city and gives herself the nicest home, right in the center of the city."
Gwen said,
"Brit the Elder's home looks different, but the inside is pretty much like everybody else's. The only real difference is the patio. She uses it for official meetings, that sort of thing. And yeah, the government buildings are pretty fancy, but they're sitting on the worst real estate in Atlantis. Think about it, everything's uphill. It's like living at the bottom of an open-pit mine. The whole city looms over you all the time, on all sides. Brit says it gives the city's leaders the proper perspective."
"You like her, don't you?" Martin asked.
"Almost everybody does."
"Almost?"
Gwen sighed.
"Yeah, well, Brit the Younger isn't her biggest fan. Like I said, it's complicated."
The craft gently touched down on Brit the Elder's patio, a space about twice the size of a basketball court. Instead of wood or stone, the deck was covered in soft grass. Rather than just being a uniform green, different species of grass had been employed, in various lengths to give the effect of a tasteful inlaid design. Three sides of the terrace were edged by thin, decorative railings. The fourth was taken up by a perfect white wall. In the center of the wall, there were large windows. There was so much light outside and so little inside that one could not see what was inside the building. The two people Martin had seen standing on the terrace as he approached were clearly guards, both male, both tall and slender, yet muscular. They had great definition. Martin could tell this because of their clothing, which consisted of a loose, light blue tunic made of a semi-transparent mesh, and a sort of kilt made of black fabric that managed to be clingy and rough at the same time. The kilt came down to just above the men's knees, exposing their powerful, hairless legs. They wore sandals with thick leather straps and chunky soles. Martin asked Gwen,
"Are we going to have to dress like that?"
Gwen smirked and looked at Martin's full-length, silver-sequined robe and matching hat.
"No, don't worry. If you're more comfortable, you can continue to wear your robes."
"You made these robes," Martin reminded her.
"Yes, but you're the ones who choose to wear them," she replied.
The mirrored glass windows parted smoothly, and two more tall, thin, muscular guards emerged, flanking a woman. She looked to be in her mid-twenties and was a bit on the short side. She was not overweight by any rational standard, but she was also certainly not skinny. She wore black-rimmed glasses and a light, gauzy dress. Her reddish-brown hair hung down to her shoulders. Though she looked young, she had the bearing of a mature woman, the kind of woman who wasn't too bothered about what you thought of her because she knew what she thought of herself. As the woman approached, Gwen said,
"Brit the Elder, I'd like you to meet..."
Brit the Elder didn't seem to hear Gwen. She spread her arms wide and said,
"Philip!"
She walked directly to Philip and looked at him, breathing in deeply.
"Philip,"
she repeated.
"It is so good to see you. I just had to say hello to you before the reception, with all those other delegates around."
Philip glanced at Gwen, who seemed thrown. He extended his right hand and said,
"Thank you, ma'am, but I don't believe we've met."
Britt took Philip's right hand in both of hers and smiled.
Of course, you're right. We haven't met, but we will soon.
Aren't we meeting right now? Philip asked.
Yes, but not for the first time. That comes later.
She smiled at Philip for another moment. Then she released his hand and pried her attention away from him.
Hello, Martin,
she said brightly.
How do you like Atlantis?
Martin bowed slightly and said,
It's spectacular, but I gotta say I'm really more impressed with how you built it. It simply never occurred to me to make a macro copy molecules like that. It's brilliant.
Even though Martin wouldn't have thought it possible, her smile got even broader.
Yes, I thought you'd appreciate it more than most. That's why I told Gwen to invite you.
Martin stammered.
That was your doing.
Yes, she suggested that someone named Tyler might get more out of the visit, but from what she's told me about you and from what I remembered, well, I knew you had to be the one to accompany Philip.
She looked back at Philip for another long moment, then she looked away, stood straight and tall, and said,
Gentlemen, it's wonderful to see you both. I'd love to chat, but we all have a reception to prepare for. Thank you, Gwen. I'll see you all tonight.
Britt the Elder turned and walked back toward the mirrored glass, followed by two of her four guards. The glass opened silently just as she arrived, then closed silently once the three of them were inside. 9. Jimmy sat in his private jail cell, which, sadly, was the nicest home he'd had in 30 years. It was clean, the toilet worked, and he didn't have to pedal it. Of course, he couldn't leave, but he was sure that would change soon. Jimmy had expected to be taken into custody once he revealed himself to the authorities, but once he was officially working with them, he expected his treatment would improve. Jimmy heard the agents coming long before he saw them. He heard the jangling of keys on the far side of the steel security door at the far end of the hall, which told him that someone was approaching. Then Jimmy heard the security door open and the sound of footsteps, which told him that the visitors were two men. Then Jimmy heard the other prisoners greeting the visitors with a mixture of insults, threats, and insulting threats, which told Jimmy that the visitors were not the normal jail guards. Finally, Jimmy heard one of the visitors silence the prisoners by shouting a torrent of the most viscerally horrifying threats Jimmy had ever heard, while the other man said nothing, which told him that the visitors were Agents Miller and Murphy. Jimmy sat up on his bed and turned to face the iron bars. The electronic lock on his door and the doors of the two adjacent cells had mysteriously stopped working, so they were secured with several loops of thick chain and big, beefy padlocks that Jimmy could have picked quite quickly if he'd had any wish to do so. Agents Miller and Murphy arrived in front of Jimmy's cell. Jimmy waited patiently while Agent Miller finished a particularly long and intricate threat, shouted not at any specific prisoner, but at anybody who had the audacity to be listening at that moment. When he was finished, Jimmy said,
Good morning, gentlemen.
Agent Murphy's face split into a wide, goofy grin.
Why, good morning, Jimmy. I hope you slept well. We're awfully sorry about your accommodations. We're still working on getting you someplace a little more comfortable.
This was not unexpected. Miller and Murphy employed an exaggerated version of the old good cop, bad cop routine that Jimmy liked to call violently unstable, rageaholic cop, friendly, talkative, youth pastor cop. As soon as it became clear that Jimmy was not a perpetrator to be bullied, but an ally to be placated, Agent Murphy had taken over most communication. Jimmy said,
I slept very well, thank you. I'd rather not be in a jail cell if I don't have to, but I know you're working on that. How was your evening? I trust the agency has found you some place to stay.
Agent Miller remained silent and white-knuckled, just staring at Jimmy and looking as if he were chewing on his own tongue. Agent Murphy chuckled lightly and said,
They've put us up at a charmingly rustic independent motel near the airport.
Oh,
Jimmy said,
that doesn't sound very convenient.
Oh, the airport's not far from downtown. It's just a little over an hour commute each way, thanks to this amazing Seattle traffic. The hotel's not much, but it's all we need. There's 10 channels worth of cable on the TV and clean sheets on our twin beds and a picturesque view of the gentlemen's club next door.
Jimmy thought he saw Agent Miller's left eye twitch. Jimmy said,
I'm sure that's very entertaining.
Miller couldn't take any more.
It might be, he said, if we had a view of the inside, but all we can see is a parking lot full of desperate, lonely men, all of whom seem to look in our window. They seem to be fascinated by the sight of two middle-aged men lying in twin beds like Ernie and Bert, watching the Weather Channel because it's the most exciting thing on. It's like being an exhibit in an alien zoo, on the planet of the scabby pervs.
Agent Murphy turned to look at his partner, and Agent Miller immediately stopped talking, clenching his jaw so hard that his teeth nearly cracked.
Now, Miller, you know that the nice man at the front desk promised to get our blinds fixed so we could close them just as soon as he gets around to it.
The agents turned their attention back to Jimmy, one viewing him with an air of friendly benevolence, the other with cold loathing. Jimmy said,
Look, guys, I'm sorry. I wish we could go back to your home office in L.A., but you know I can't fly. You saw what being next to me did to your phone. You really want to ride in the plane with me?
We could drive it, Miller growled. It can be done in 18 hours if you're motivated.
Jimmy had no doubt that Agent Miller was motivated.
You'd have to get a car with no integrated circuitry, so that means an unrestored car from the 50s. Then you'd have to take roads where traffic would never get closer than 30 feet from us for more than, say, 5 seconds at a time. So that would mean taking little roads through eastern Washington, Idaho, and Nevada to get there.
You seem to have given this a lot of thought,
Agent Murphy said.
That route is how I got to Seattle,
Jimmy said.
On your bicycle?
Yep.
The agents looked at each other, then looked at Jimmy. He was in his 60s and very thin, but neither man doubted for an instant that he was telling the truth.
If you must get me to L.A., the fastest way would be to get the Treasury Department to hire a boxcar on the longest freight train you can find going to California. It's faster than driving the long way, and it'll keep me away from any electronics I might damage.
How much would that cost?
Agent Murphy asked.
Sadly, a lot more than your hotel room for a week.
Agent Miller grunted,
A week?
Jimmy thought he could hear tendons popping in the agent's hands. Jimmy put his hands up defensively.
Maybe less. Hey, hopefully less.
Agent Miller muttered,
It better be less.
Jimmy smiled and said,
It will be. It will.
Good.
Probably.
10. After their meeting with Britt the Elder, Gwen explained that she had to prepare for the reception an hour later. She called out to one of the impossibly good-looking guards, who somehow managed to sashay over to her in a way that was still undeniably manly. He stopped less than a foot in front of Gwen, looked deeply into her eyes, and in a husky voice said,
Yes, ma'am. What can I do for you?
Gwen said,
Please escort my friends to their quarters and arrange for their transportation to the reception.
The guard glanced at Martin and Philip, not like a man who was meeting new people, but rather like a man who was judging the weight of two heavy sacks of flour he'd been asked to carry. He looked back to Gwen's eyes and said,
If that is what you want, that is what I will do.
Good. That's what I want.
Is it?
It is.
Is that all you want?
Yes.
Really?
Gwen frowned.
Yes, that is all I want from you.
The guard smirked, but his eyes registered confusion. Martin made a note of it. Not hurt, confusion. The guard said,
Then it'll be my pleasure to transport these.
The guard paused long enough to glance down at Martin and Philip again.
These men to their quarters.
He leaned in closer to Gwen.
If you need anything else from me. Anything at all. I trust you'll ask.
Gwen said,
That'll be all.
She turned to Martin and Philip, and her smile came back, but not as strongly as before.
Guys, it's just so good to see both of you.
Philip asked,
Hey, Gwen, the reception, how formally should we dress?
What's the nicest thing you brought?
We both had custom-tailored tuxedos made.
Gwen laughed, but it was out of astonishment.
Wow, class move. Well done. I'd say wear the tux, but use your robe for the top layer instead of the jacket. Just adjust the robe so it's open to the sternum, like a tuxedo jacket, or wear the robe open. Oh, and bring the hats and staffs. You won't need to do any magic, but it's good for show. See you then.
With that, she turned and left via the same sliding glass door that Britt the Elder had used. The four men on the terrace, Martin, Philip, and the two guards, watched her leave with great fondness. As soon as the door slid shut behind her, the guards' demeanor changed completely. The guard tasked with showing the wizards to their rooms looked to the other guard and shook his head dismissively. The second guard chuckled mirthlessly and shrugged. The guard assigned to Martin and Philip looked down at them. He was a full head taller than Martin and had no noticeable body fat. He said, "Follow me. Keep up." With that, he led the two wizards to a small staircase leading to the park below. The grass was perfectly manicured. The trees were immaculately pruned. The flowers and shrubs were carefully arranged and lovingly maintained. They happened past a gardener toiling in the sun. He was young and muscular. He wore a kilt and sandals, but no shirt. As he heard footsteps approaching, the gardener languidly turned to face whoever was approaching. He bowed his head slightly, pursed his lips, and raised his eyes to look through his long hair, which had artfully fallen into his eyes. He saw that the approaching footsteps belonged to a guard and two men, and he immediately slouched. His expression soured. He made eye contact with the guard, who shrugged and shook his head. Martin quickened his pace to walk next to the guard and said, "Hi!" The guard said nothing.
"So,"
Martin asked,
"what's your name?"
"Never mind,"
the guard replied.
"Oh, come on," Martin said. "You must have a name."
"I do, but it's not worth the trouble of telling you. What would you do with it? Use it to greet me if you see me again? What good would that do me? I'd have to explain to the other men who you are, what you are, and worse, how you came to know me well enough to use my name."
Martin said, "I was just trying to make conversation." The guard considered this and sneered.
"Is that what the males do where you come from? Make conversation? Do you squawk and titter like the women folk do?"
"Sometimes, I guess. It depends on what we're talking about."
The guard grimaced.
"Well, that explains it."
"Explains what?"
Philip asked, still lagging behind.
"The one who brought you here, Gwen, she comes from the same place as you?"
"Yes."
"Well, if males like you are what she's used to, then it's no wonder she has yet to select a servant."
"A servant?" Martin prodded.
"The sorceresses who rule this city each choose a servant to tend to them. Some more than one. Britt the Elder has several."
"What all does the servant do?"
The guard squinted down at Martin. Philip sped his pace slightly to be closer to the conversation. He wanted to know where this was going. The guard repeated,
"He tends to them."
Philip asked,
"And this is a sought-after position among the men?"
"Yes, of course. Men from everywhere who consider themselves a likely candidate to be chosen flock to Atlantis to be near the sorceresses in hopes of being chosen."
"Seriously, your loftiest goal is to be a servant?"
"To a sorceress, yes. Their powers afford a servant every luxury you can imagine, and the prestige of being selected is second to none. In return for all this, a servant's only duty is to tend to the needs of his sorceress."
"Cooking, cleaning, that sort of thing?"
Martin asked.
The guard snorted. "Never. They're menials for that."
Martin started to understand what Gwen had meant when she said that there were aspects of Atlantean society of which she was not proud. As the trio walked, skirting the edge of the park, Martin and Philip began to see that any job that involved being seen in public was being done by a tall, brooding man. The guards, the gardeners, the food vendors, the porters, they were all men, all beautiful, and all noticeably disappointed by the sight of Martin and Philip. Also, most of them were shirtless, even disturbingly the food vendors. At last they came to the elevator station. The guard called it the cable car, but it had no cable and looked nothing like a car. It was simply an open platform bordered by a thin safety railing. An empty path that could be called a track led straight up the curved wall that defined the city, but there were no rails, cables, or cogs. At first, Martin thought the empty path had been painted an extremely dark green color. Then he realized that it was clear and that he was seeing into the ocean itself on the other side of the basin. They waited a few moments while a few more men boarded the platform, standing as far away from the wizards and their chaperone as they could. Then, silently, the platform started working its way up the side of the city. Martin looked down at the platform on which he stood. It was milky white and translucent, and it had a grid pattern cut into its surface. For traction, he supposed. Martin stamped his foot, listening to and feeling the vibration. He muttered,
"More diamond?"
"Maybe," Philip said. "Or maybe a toughened glass like Pyrex or something. I've seen a few different materials here, but they all seem to be crystalline."
"Makes sense. It'd be easy to produce using her molecular construction method, and the structures she built to be perfectly monolithic."
"Yes," Philip said, seeing what Martin meant. "Then she could use the shell, or whatever her version of it is called, to move them around at will without any fear of them losing their structural integrity."
It's brilliant," Martin said.
"Yes, I have to admit it is,"
Philip said. Martin and Philip became aware that the guard was looking down at them, his face a mask of undisguised loathing. Martin changed the subject.
"So," Martin said, using his best nonchalant voice, "you say Gwen hasn't chosen a servant?"
"Yes,"
the guard said, looking away.
"That is what I said."
"And she's the only sorceress who hasn't?"
"Yes."
"I see. Have many of you tried to become Gwen's servant?"
"We have all tried to become her servant. We are all still trying to become her servant. She is the most sought-after woman in all of Atlantis."
Martin said,
"Well, I can understand that. She is adorable."
The guard laughed.
"If by adorable you mean that she is short and strange, and that she talks in gibberish like you two, she is sought after solely because she is the only sorceress who has not chosen a servant. That is all. Someday she will choose a servant, and if that servant is me, it means that the most difficult work I'll ever need to do is pretending to enjoy her company."
They rode in uncomfortable silence for a moment as the platform followed the contour of Atlantis's massive bowl. Now that he was looking for it, the walls of the buildings were clearly some crystalline matter, colored a uniform milky white. Palm trees, footpaths, and small rooftop patches of soft grass broke up the jumble of buildings clinging to the wall's permanent incline. For the first time, the guard spoke without being asked a direct question.
"Gwen came from wherever you live. Tell me, was there a male there whom Gwen found attractive?"
Martin chose to ignore the question.
"Yes,"
Philip said.
"Yes, there was. Why do you ask?"
The guard looked around, then said quietly,
"If you were to tell me what this man that Gwen was attracted to was like, I might act more like him and perhaps become her servant."
"I see,"
Philip said, almost giggling with glee.
"That's an interesting idea."
"Then will you help me?"
"Yes," Philip said. "But before I can help you, you should at least tell me your name."
"I'm sorry,"
the guard said. He stood straight and puffed out his chest as if he were about to say the most momentous thing Philip had ever heard.
"My name,"
the guard said in a deep, resonant voice,
"is Ampix."
Philip said,
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Ampix. My name is Philip."
Martin kept looking at the city moving past and shook his head.
"So, Philip,"
Ampix asked,
"what can you tell me about this man that Gwen found attractive?"
"I don't have to tell you anything. You've met him. It's my friend, Martin."
Philip put a hand on Martin's shoulder and gestured toward him with the other hand like a game show spokesmodel displaying a new car. Ampix looked at Martin with an undisguised mixture of horror and disgust. Martin glared at Philip. Philip beamed back at him. Most of the balance of the trip to their quarters passed in silence. Ampix watched Martin's every move. Martin tried not to show how profoundly uncomfortable Ampix was making him. Philip tried not to laugh out loud. The platform arrived at a station about two-thirds of the way up the side of the bowl. Ampix led them off of the platform and down a broad, grassy footpath. They passed shops selling food, clothing, and hard goods, all of them small and tasteful, and all of them staffed by good-looking men. Ampix asked Martin several questions, but Martin resisted answering, or even speaking to him. The only question that got any traction was when he asked Martin what he did. Martin tersely replied that he was a wizard, and was met with a blank stare.
"You know, a wizard?" Martin said. "I do magic?"
Martin had expected that this would at least impress Ampix. Martin was wrong. "Why?" Ampix asked.
"Why what? Why do I do magic?"
"Yes, why do you do magic?" Ampix asked as if it were the most obvious question in the world. Martin looked at Philip, who shrugged. Finally, Martin answered,
"Why wouldn't I do magic? Wouldn't you do magic if you could?"
"Never," Ampix said.
"Well, why not?"
Ampix scrunched his face and said, "Magic, it is woman's work." Martin just stared at him. Philip piped up.
"You do understand that this entire city was built with magic?"
"Yes," Ampix said, "by a woman, and it's very impressive in its way. I mean no disrespect to women. Someone has to do the magic, and they are very good at it, but it's not fit work for a real man."
"And what work is fit for a real man?"
Philip asked. "Look around you and see for yourself," Ampix said. "Guarding things, tending to the flowers, selling clothing, serving food. Some of us cut hair."
"Manly work," Philip said.
"Yes." Now Martin had to make sure he was hearing things properly.
"And what about building things, inventing and running the government?"
Ampix said. "The women seem to enjoy doing those things, and they're good at it, so we leave them to it while we tend to what's important." Finally, they reached what Martin and Philip instantly recognized as a hotel. Inside, the thin, handsome young man behind the counter told them they were expected. He checked with the manager, who was not a sorceress, but she was a woman, and got their room number. They boarded an elevator that had no noticeable workings, but which still transported them between floors. Ampix took his leave of them, and they entered their room. They were so dumbstruck by what they found inside that they forgot for a moment to put their suitcases down. The room was two stories tall, with a staircase and a loft forming the second floor. There was a bed and a bathroom and a kitchenette on the ground floor, and a second bed and bath on the second. The second floor loft was slightly less deep than the first floor, giving the impression of a grand balcony. Both floors had an unobstructed view of the room's back wall, which was also the city's outer wall. Essentially, one entire wall of their room was a massive curved window out into the ocean. The clarity of the ocean in this area and time meant that they could see light filtering down from the surface, itself an endless, undulating, silvery plain extending off into infinity. Schools of fish swam past as they watched. Looking below them, they saw no bottom to the sea, just a hazy gradient shifting from light blue to dark blue, then to black.
"Wow," Martin said. "I did not expect that."
Philip snapped himself out of his amazed stupor and said,
"I didn't expect for the god's name to be Ampix."
Martin rounded on Philip and said,
"Yeah, and I certainly didn't expect for you to help him to try to cozy up to Gwen."
"Oh, calm down," Philip said. "Acting like you isn't going to help him get anywhere with Gwen. It doesn't seem to have helped you."
"Is that supposed to make me feel better?"
Philip hoisted his suitcase onto the bed and started unpacking.
"No, it's meant to be the truth. You need to get your mind off of Gwen. We have bigger problems."
Martin looked around them.
What problems? That this place is beautiful?
I know, Philip said. And I don't like it. Not one bit. I don't like this city, and I don't like that Brit the Elder. There's something wrong there.
She certainly seemed to like you, Martin said.
Like I said, wrong.
Well, like Gwen said, she's the future version of herself. Maybe... Philip interrupted him.
No, Martin, she's not the future version of herself. She's one current version of herself from the future. And I know what you are going to say. The two of you must have known each other in her past. That is what you are going to say, right?
Yeah. So what? So the two of you met and hit it off in her past. That's nice.
No, Philip said. It's not nice. It won't be nice. And if it is nice, that'll make it worse.
You're not making any sense, Martin said.
No, reality isn't making sense. I'm just describing it. By suggesting that we meet and get along, she essentially ordered me to meet her and get along. Now, when I do meet her, I'll be subconsciously primed to like her, even if I don't, just because it supposedly already happened.
Martin said, Oh, okay, I get it. You're back on your free will trip.
I'm not back on it, Philip said. I'm still on it. I never wasn't on it. Make no mistake. For as long as you know me, for the rest of my life, I will insist that I have free will.
But if you're going to insist that you have free will no matter what, Martin said, then that's not free will. Like I keep telling you, that's not a choice, that's a program. You might as well be an inanimate wooden sign that says, I have free will, for all that proves.
Philip looked at Martin for a moment, then, in an unnaturally calm voice, said,
It's true. You do always say that. And what do I always say in return?
That I should shut up.
Indeed.
And none of that does anything to prove that either of us has free will. In fact,
Martin!
Yes?
Shut up.
11.
Martin and Philip arrived at the reception about a half hour before the official start time, and the place was already bustling. It was a large ballroom in one of the ridiculously impressive buildings at the center and bottom of the city. The ballroom was under a large dome that protruded from the roof of one of the buildings. Because all of the buildings in Atlantis were constructed from molecularly engineered crystalline materials, the walls were a milky, opaque white that faded to perfect transparency at their peaks. If one looked up, they were treated to a dizzying view of the city looming over them, and the dark blue Mediterranean twilight looming over the city. As the sky got darker, lights came on. Martin didn't know if the lights were fires, magical contrivances, or oil lamps, but they illuminated the buildings from the inside like thousands of huge paper lanterns stacked all around him. The outer perimeter of the room was populated at regular intervals by large white statues of various important women, depicted in the style of Greek goddesses, which worked well for Wonder Woman, but not so well for Margaret Thatcher. Philip and Martin spent several minutes soaking in the spectacle and scanning the room for a familiar face. There were many wizards, shaman, sorcerers, and other assorted magic folk, all of them men. There were many guards, servers, and hosts, also all male. They had given up seeing someone they already knew and were about to start actively mingling when they heard Gwen's voice. They turned and saw her poking her head through a small door that was camouflaged by a particularly ornate molding. She motioned for them to come with her. Philip and Martin went through the door and found themselves in a bustling room full of chefs, expediters, and important-looking behind-the-scenes management types, all female.
Wow, you boys clean up nice,
Gwen said. The men thanked her. They had taken her advice and worn their tuxedos, only replacing the jackets with their wizard robes. Martin and Philip returned the compliment, both feeling silly, because the fact that Gwen looked great that evening was self-evident. She wore a simple black knee-length cocktail dress, which she had clearly designed herself. The dress had full-length sleeves that flared at the wrists to the standard, shell-specified width for a European wizard's robe. Where another dress may have been backless or had a zipper, Gwen's featured a tapered hood, which pooled slightly around her shoulders and spilled down her back. She held a thin, graceful wooden wand in her hand. Gwen looked at her own outfit and thanked the men.
"I made it myself,"
she added.
"I wanted to wear something that reflected where I had come from. Speaking of which, I have something for you."
She reached into the hood of her dress and pulled out two bow ties, one sky blue to match Philip's robe, the other silver sequined to match Martin's.
"I didn't have time to make cummerbunds, so you have to keep your robes pulled shut. But for a formal occasion like this, you probably should anyway."
The men quickly pulled off their black ties, replacing them with the new ties Gwen had made. When they were done, Gwen straightened Philip's tie for him.
"Is mine straight?"
Martin asked Gwen. Gwen looked and said,
"Yeah, close enough. Well, guys, the Brits are going to get things started any minute. I've got to run. See you out there."
Gwen scampered away, through the kitchen staff, around a corner and out of sight. Martin watched her go. Philip watched Martin, smirking.
"Remember when you and Gwen first met?"
Philip asked.
"Yes, I remember. It was less than 3 months ago," Martin said.
"Remember how you would shamelessly try to get her attention?"
"Yeah."
"Then why don't you remember how well she responded to it?"
Philip went back through the door into the ballroom. Martin stood for a moment before following. They spent a few minutes sampling hors d'oeuvres and making small talk with a wizard from China who had introduced himself to Philip. His name was John, and he'd been educated at Cambridge. He knew of Philip because he was still in contact with Eddie, who had originally time-traveled to ancient China before later moving to medieval England and getting tangled in Jimmy's massive web of lies. The conversation seemed pleasant enough, but Martin couldn't concentrate on it. At first because of his preoccupation with Gwen, then because of the two men staring at him. The men were standing by the wall at the far side of the room. They sneered and glared at Martin and Philip as they spoke. They wore stiff black tuxedos and white shirts with high, starched collars. They held top hats in their white-gloved hands. Martin smiled and waved. The men smiled back, and their white gloves added a hint of elegance when one of the men gave Martin the finger. Martin considered walking over, asking them what their problem was, and offering to help them fix it. But then the lights dimmed, and a hush fell over the room. A large, ornate door at the far end of the ballroom opened, and a long line of women emerged. There were around 40 of them. They were all different from one another, yet they were all lovely. They represented every race and ethnicity, and their ages ranged from the late teens to a couple of women in their 40s. Some were tiny, some were large, but all seemed healthy. Few were particularly thin, or noticeably not thin. Gwen would later explain that in their version of the Shell program, which they called the Interface, they had found a way to set a sorceress's nutritional intake at an optimized constant, and as such, their weight tended to settle at a natural balance point. The room was filled with men, and men cannot help themselves. As the Atlantean sorceresses filed into the room, the visitors from other times and places naturally noted how many of them they found attractive before losing count and succumbing to acute option paralysis. Gwen was toward the back of the line, followed by a tall, slightly built young woman with black hair and a prominent nose. Behind her were two versions of Brit. The Brit at the end of the line stood straight and tall. She smiled brightly and wore a spectacular evening gown and heels. She seemed completely at ease with herself and her surroundings. The Brit who was second to last slouched slightly, smiled weakly, and wore a blue cocktail dress and a matching pair of canvas high tops. The sorceresses lined up, dwarfed by several of the statues that adorned the hall. Together they formed a dazzling backdrop for Brit the Elder, who walked forward from her place at the end of the line and addressed the room.
"Welcome, gentlemen, to Atlantis. We sorceresses summoned you here for this summit.
Martin and Gwen shared a smile at this.
By now, Britt the Elder continued, I'm sure most of you know why you've been invited. Each of your communities has suffered at the hands of one of our own kind who has abused his or her power. Some of you have been lucky, and your trouble has been slight. Others have had your entire community threatened.
Martin remembered Jimmy, his attempt to remodel all of England into a smaller, dumber version of Tolkien's Middle-earth, and kill all opposing wizards in the process. He wondered if any of these other people had a story that could top it. Britt the Elder continued,
Starting tomorrow, in this very room, we will work together to prevent any such problems in the future. Tonight, our only task is to meet, talk, and get to know one another. We have in this room two representatives from each of our communities, which are spread out across the globe and throughout all of recorded human history. If you can't find an interesting conversation in this room, it's because you are boring.
A polite laugh followed and faded to silence almost instantly when Britt the Elder waved it away.
Before I let you all start getting to know one another, I'd like to make a few introductions. Most of you know at least one of the women behind me, as all of them came here from one of your communities. And of course, it would be terribly time-consuming to introduce them all by name now. Besides, who can remember that many names? Instead, I will take this opportunity to introduce my two fellow members of Atlantis's ruling Council of Three. I, of course, am Britt. I founded and built Atlantis.
There was another round of applause, which she dismissed after a moment with another wave of her hand. Britt the Elder motioned vaguely to her right, causing a spotlight that seemed to emanate from empty space to wink into existence and focus on the tall, dark-haired woman who stood to Gwen's right. Britt the Elder said,
This is Ida. She is the duly elected president of Atlantis. She has served a little over 3 years of her 4-year term.
There was another round of polite applause as the president, Ida, stepped forward and bowed slightly to greet the crowd. When the applause died down, Britt the Elder said,
And of course this,
pausing to make another, slightly more expansive hand gesture to her right, which caused the spotlight to shift to the second version of Britt, who started to smile and wave as Britt the Elder continued,
Is a past version of me.
Britt the Elder clasped her hands in front of her gown, causing the spotlight to cut off abruptly.
So that's it for the preliminaries,
Britt the Elder said.
Please have a good time tonight, and know that while we are here to do serious work, it'll be a lot more fun if we're all friends. Do make an effort to get to know each other, and be sure to fill out and wear your name tags.
There was an awkward pause, followed by one of the women in the line stepping forward and whispering something to Britt the Elder, who turned and addressed Britt the Younger.
Dear, didn't you see to the name tags?
The other Britt replied,
He said you were going to do it.
Yes, but I meant that you would. You are me, remember?
Well, how was I supposed to know that?
I knew it, so why wouldn't you?
Britt the Younger gritted her teeth.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't read your mind.
Britt the Elder's smile grew strained.
It's your mind, too, but that's okay,
Britt the Elder said.
No need to beat yourself up.
Britt the Younger muttered,
Oh, I don't know.
Luckily, one of the first tricks every community of magic practitioners figured out was the ability to replicate small objects, so they very quickly had all of the adhesive name tags and felt tip markers they could possibly need. Everybody wrote his or her name, time of origin, and time and place of residence. The next few hours were spent making small talk and eating small food. Even with the name tags, Martin was overwhelmed by the sheer number of new names and faces to which he was subjected. Usually in a situation like this, a few memorable people would emerge from the noise and get firmly cemented in his mind. But the problem was that everyone he met here was memorable. He met Chinese wizards, Hindu fakirs, Arabic sorcerers, and a Navajo medicine man. He met Aztecs, Incas, Swamis, and gurus. One guy was wearing a loincloth and a hat made of a wolf skull, which he insisted was his dress ensemble. Later, Martin worked up the nerve to ask him a few questions. It turned out his name was Richard, and he was from Portland, Oregon, in the year 2003.
"Yeah, that's where you're from originally," Martin said. "But where do you live?"
Richard said, "Portland. In the year 2003, I own a food truck." And then there were the women. To Martin's chagrin, he still really only had eyes for Gwen, but those eyes were still able to see, and before them trotted a parade of smart, interesting women who knew about the file, knew how to use it, and understood Martin's situation better than anyone who didn't know those things possibly could. He tried to remember names, but it was impossible. Lisa, Rebecca, Mallory, Jennifer, Sabrina, Stacy, Allie. It all washed over him like he was a stone at the bottom of a river. At one point, Martin found himself standing next to the woman who had been introduced as the president. She was deep in conversation with a particularly tall and muscular man in a net shirt and kilt who Martin suspected was her servant. Martin had never met a president before.
"Madam President," he said in his smoothest voice, "it's a pleasure to meet you."
He offered her his hand. She tore her attention away from the muscular man, who was telling a story that was about, as near as Martin could tell, repeatedly punching someone in a novel manner. The president shook Martin's hand, and while reading his name tag, said,
"Welcome, Martin. Thanks for coming. Atlantis must be a big change from medieval England. Oh."
The president brightened up immediately.
"You're from Gwen's group. You're the ones who nearly got beaten to death by orcs."
"That's us," Martin said.
"What are orcs?" the tall man asked, now interested.
"Oh, they're these big creatures with bluish skin and horrible teeth," Martin explained.
"And you fought these creatures off?" the servant asked.
"Yes,"
Martin said.
"Well, in a way. We created an army of demons to scare them off so we could make our escape."
"Oh," the servant said. "So you had someone else fight for you while you fled. Impressive." The president made an effort to hide her amusement. Her servant did not. After a moment of mirth at Martin's expense, the servant continued his story.
"So it's a brawl, people fighting everywhere, but I want a challenge, so I decide I'm just going to hit guys on the top of the head like this."
The servant made an exaggerated swinging motion, wheeling his arms over his head and bringing his fists straight down in front of him.
"I just wanted to see if I could knock guys out like that. Turns out, I can."
The president seemed impressed. Martin moved on. Elsewhere in the same room, Philip was talking to a man whose name tag said Gupta about how their respective communities' versions of the Shell program worked.
The Shell looks for certain details of our wizard robes and staffs to determine who should and shouldn't be allowed to cast spells,"
Philip said with some difficulty while eating a piece of fried shrimp.
"Clever," Gupta said. "We call ours the Gateway. It identifies us based entirely by our fingernail length."
Gupta held up his hands, showing Philip his dark, curved nails, the shortest of which was at least 5 inches.
"Wow," Philip said. "Impressive."
Philip felt a tap on his shoulder. He turned to find himself facing both Brits. He smiled, but inside he cringed. He considered Brit the Elder to be a walking refutation of everything he believed about free will, and as such, he found even looking at her unpleasant. This was made worse by the fact that on another level, he found looking at her quite enjoyable, which made him angry with himself. It also didn't help that Brit the Elder again seemed delighted to see him.
"Philip,"
she said, positively beaming.
"I have someone I'd very much like you to meet. Philip, Chairman of the Wizards of Camelot. This is me, approximately 182 years ago, from my point of view."
Brit the Younger grudgingly made eye contact with Philip while limply shaking his hand. Philip said,
"Good to meet you."
Brit the Elder's smile grew even brighter as she looked at Philip and Brit the Younger, both of whom were radiating discomfort.
Yes, lovely. This brings back such memories. You two are going to get along famously. I just know it.
She turned to Gupta, glancing deftly at his name tag.
Come, Mr. Gupta, let's give these two some time to get acquainted. I could introduce you to a servant who gives the best manicures.
Philip and Britt the Younger watched as Britt the Elder led the bewildered